This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we talk about the state of journalism today and its future. Our guest is Robert Kaiser. He is associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post. Kaiser and the paper's executive editor, Leonard Downey Jr., are the authors of the new book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. The book examines the difference between good and bad journalism and how journalism affects our lives. The authors say, among the good news, the best journalism in America is better than it has ever been. Among the bad news, too much of what has been offered as news in recent years has been untrustworthy, irresponsible, misleading, or incomplete. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments about journalism. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. The number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Before becoming an editor at the Washington Post, Robert Kaiser spent 20 years as a reporter. He covered the war in Vietnam and spent 3 years during the Cold War as the paper's correspondent in Moscow. He's the author of 6 books, 3 of them on Russia. His Russia, the People, and the Power, published in 1976, was a bestseller. Again, our telephone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Robert Kaiser, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Let's begin, if we might, with some recent examples of the best and the worst work in journalism.
Well, unfortunately, the worst is all too easy to find examples of. You can see it any night on late-night local television in almost any market in America. There's actually a great surplus of bad journalism today. It's all over the place. So much of what passes for news is just superficial headlines, ball scores, the latest traffic accident. One of the themes of our book is that there should be a lot more digging and revealing and less belaboring the obvious. But let me think of a good story. There's a wonderful story in last week's Los Angeles Times. I was out there on tour promoting this book and read it about the Egyptian pilot that brought down the plane. Who brought down the plane? The Egyptian air jet that crashed in the Atlantic a couple of years ago. And the Los Angeles Times, in the best traditions of investigative reporting, found a colleague, another pilot from Egypt Air, who knew the whole inside story about this guy and why he was angry and what was going on. And it just made a marvelous piece of journalism, which was a big front-page story in the Los Angeles Times late last week. That's the kind of thing we need more of, journalists digging in and finding out stuff that people don't want to have found out. That's the best sort of reporting.
Yeah. Now, that story in the L.A. Times involving another pilot as a source, was that the only source?
No, it's actually... I'm sure you could find this on the L.A. Times website. It's a very artful piece of investigative reporting because that source was critical. Mm-hmm. He gave them a kind of roadmap that made everything else make sense. But then they found lots of other sources. I didn't count them, but numerous, who could support tidbits of the story. No one else had the same overview that this colleague had. But other elements of his story could be confirmed from other sources. And I think for the L.A. Times, and certainly for me as a reader, it reached that stage of critical mass where you said, yes, this guy obviously knows what he's talking about and can be relied on.
Yeah. So a couple of elements of a good story, then, from what you've just said, uncovering information that's important and being able to back up the story.
The great justification for this wonderful license that you and I both enjoy in American society, called the First Amendment to the Constitution, is that we perform the watchdog role that the First Amendment implies, that we actually do keep an eye on powerful institutions and individuals who can affect people's lives. And certainly to Len and me, the most important journalism does just that. You find out things about the way power is being exercised, you expose it to public view, and then you let the public decide what to make of it and what to do about it, if anything.
You note that surveys of the public have found strong disapproval of stories One of the stories that you mentioned in the book is the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. But then when the Barbara Walters interview of Lewinsky aired, it drew an audience bigger than any previous audience for a network news program.
That's right.
So what's going on?
You know, we felt that ambivalence in the Washington Post newsroom from which I'm speaking to you. I think it was the nature of the story. Lots of people felt, yeah, who needs more of this? And yet we were fascinated by it. It was such an incredible human spectacle. And I think the chance, you know, having read so much about her and heard so much about her for so long, and we'd never even heard her voice, when she finally materialized with Barbara Walters, people were just intrigued to see what she looked like and take the measure of her. That's one of the great things television does in modern life, is allow us to take the measure of people like that. I think it's often a misleading measure that we get, but nevertheless, it's fun to watch. But, you know, people were ambivalent about the Lewinsky story. There was a huge argument about whether it was relevant to Clinton's exercise of the presidency or not. We here certainly thought it was relevant. It was a White House intern. It happened in the White House. The apparent attempt to change the testimony of Betty Curry was certainly newsworthy, in our opinion, and so on. But there was certainly basis for a good disagreement about that. We didn't require anyone to agree with us, but we conducted our business on that basis, as did most other news organizations. And the public repeatedly told us that, particularly in the end of it, that we'd gone too far. Mm-hmm. But, you know, our response was, look, the House of Representatives has impeached the guy. The Senate is going to vote to remove him from office. It's become a big thing, no matter what you think of how it began.
Mm-hmm. American journalism has generally scored high marks from the public in the aftermath of the attacks of September 11th. But I recently started to read a report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism that reports that the performance of journalists and public confidence in their work is slipping.
Well, and so is the journalism slipping, I think. We were very taken with what happened after September 11th and write about it in the book as an example of really distinguished journalism, but also proof that American journalists in all media still knew what their job was when the great national crisis occurred. The networks, you know, without blinking, threw away their commercials, stayed on the air for 96 hours or whatever it was. Everyone demonstrated, I think, that they knew what the difference between right and wrong was when it came to journalistic obligation. And yet already now you see backsliding. The morning news shows today and Good Morning America and so on are back to doing celebrities. They've moved away from hard news. There was even a quote from the producer of the Today Show saying, "We stuck with the war too long," as though somehow some sin had been committed. The evening so-called news magazine shows, Dateline and 48 Hours and such, they're also, having gone through a period in which they did a lot of serious foreign coverage and terrorism coverage and so on, they've gone back to melodramatic crime stories and things like that. So it's really a sad tale that having demonstrated so well how good they could be, so many journalists have now, and programs and newspapers have gone back to it. Well, I guess it's become business as usual.
How does a news organization decide we've spent too much time with a war?
Well, actually, that quotation arose in the context of the fact that Good Morning America was gaining on the Today Show in the ratings, and the producer was looking for an explanation of this phenomenon. I have no idea what the basis is. You do hear experts all the time, so self-styled experts, announcing that the public doesn't care about serious news. It really prefers celebrities and junk. And we consider that kind of journalistic version of blaming the victim. That just isn't right. The biggest and best news organizations are all very successful in the marketplace. The Washington Post, I say immodestly, has a huge business, makes enormous profits, is read in half the households of Greater Washington every day of the year, 70% on Sunday. We must be doing something right. But people who don't know how or aren't inclined to spend the money to create really fine journalism like to say, oh, people don't want that anyway. I just think that's not fair to citizens.
So quality papers, quality newscasts, they can result in greater circulation and better ratings.
You know, look at the example of your own network. your listeners, I'm sure, like NPR listeners all over the country, sit down once or twice a year and demonstrate their affection for good journalism by writing a check and paying for it. To me, that's kind of the most compelling proof. And the audience, for all things considered, and Morning Edition, is vast now, many millions, much bigger, interestingly, than the combined audience of all the cable news networks. NPR seems to be vivid proof that quality pays.
What do you see good and bad about National Public Radio?
Mostly we see good, I'd say. I was a commentator, I should say, for honest disclosure, on Weekend, All Things Considered, in the early 80s. If you think back over those 20 years and how the NPR news organization has flourished and grown, it's quite dramatic. The number of foreign correspondents, there used to be one foreign correspondent when Robert Siegel was alone in London. I remember it well. It was just at that time. Now there are foreign correspondents all over the globe. They're doing more coverage. The programs have been extended in time. And they're doing really hard news reporting. I think the drawback to NPR is the drawback to all forms of broadcast journalism. It is the space limitation, as we think of it in the newspaper business. 2 hours of radio, while a lot, an enormous amount by broadcast standards, the number of words that you can pack into 2 hours of radio can easily be fit into two or two and a half pages of a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a strict limit on how many stories can be covered and in what depth. I think in the traditions of NPR News, investigative reporting, digging below the surface and catching malefactors doing bad things, was less common. But I'm pleased to say that it seems to be becoming more common. There was an absolutely wonderful Elizabeth Arnold piece during the Olympics about the land deal that some entrepreneur in Utah had put together, taking advantage of the Olympics to make a killing by getting some government land swapped to him for some not equal valued piece that he gave back to the government. And I listened to that with great admiration and thought, gee, that's just the kind of investigative reporting that used to be rare on NPR, but it is starting to happen. So generally, I'm a big enthusiast.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Robert Kaiser, one of the authors of The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril. He is associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A listener is waiting to talk with us on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Kaiser, one of the problems here is that people don't know they're being denied good information when the information isn't printed. And one particularly egregious area in which the mainstream press has failed to do a good reporting job is in the activities of the right wing politically, in not only being able to use sleaze against liberal enemies, but then manufacturing and hyping that news, their distortion, so that the mainstream press buys it. And sometimes I fear that even your newspaper has fallen victim to this sleaze. A look at David Brock's book, which is getting very bad treatment, by the way, unfairly, in an attempt to balance this, Blinded by the Right, provides many an example of how the right wing literally merchandised its way into the mainstream press. And I wish you'd comment on that, because the silence of the press, it's, to me, appalling.
Well, these are subjective judgments. I obviously don't share your view of our failure, but I understand your point. I myself spent 6 months on an enormous and ambitious investigation of the activities and philanthropy of Richard Mellon Scaife, which produced several long articles that ran in the Washington Post in the spring of 1998, and much of which showed exactly what you're talking about, how think tanks and organizations funded by Scaife and other conservatives had made a huge impression on American society. We've certainly written many times about the right-wing public relations effort, and about left-wing public relations efforts also. Howie Kurtz, our media reporter, had a very long piece about Brock and his book that ran in the Styles section about a month ago, the biggest free advertisement Mr. Brock has received, I would say, and an interesting story about what he had written about and about his biography as a political activist once on the right. I hear in your tone of voice the emotion of a committed liberal, maybe, someone on the other side of the argument. It's hard to explain sometimes to committed ideological people how unideological most newspaper people are and most newspaper news people are. We certainly want to be fair and thorough. We certainly want to explain efforts to manipulate us and how they work. We've written an awful lot about the Pentagon's and the White House's efforts to manipulate us during this war, for example. But I don't see this exactly the way you do. I don't feel the victim of some unreported effort by the right to manipulate us. You, of course, are entitled to a different view.
Is the listener still there? No. Okay. I want to thank him for his call. Some people, you know, hold the view that the media has a liberal bias. Others view the media as the standard bearers for the powers that be.
Boy, are you right, Celeste. As we go around the country speaking and promoting this book, we hear from all sides, which is, you know, on some level sort of reassuring. If everybody thinks that we're against them or for their enemy, I confess that gives me some perverse sense that perhaps we're in the right place. But the big problem in Lens and my view that we write about in this book is not a systematic bias in any direction. It's that there's just too much opinion in the news. If you read Bernard Goldberg's book called Bias, which amazingly is the number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list this week, you will see, no matter what your personal politics, you will see egregious examples, in my opinion, of journalists inserting their personal opinion into what's supposed to be a news story. This does happen, and it's bad when it happens. And I think it's a mistake for journalists to ignore that it's a problem, because it really infuriates people. People are smart and independent-minded, and when we tell them what to think about a story, they rightly resent it, and we shouldn't do that. But I don't, you know, this idea that we're in somebody's pocket and that people are whispering in our ears and telling us what to do does not correspond to reality and doesn't help anybody understand what's really going on in the news. We wrote this book to help educate consumers, in effect. We want the consumers of news, your listeners, people that like NPR radio are exactly our ideal audience. We want them to understand why they're getting what they're getting and what's going on in the news business. It isn't, however, a dark conspiracy. It's a collection of greed and human failing and commercialism that's making this happen.
You mentioned greed. You note in the book that the Tribune Company expects a 30% profit margin. Is that typical?
Well, it's sort of the high end, but, you know, they got it. So that's the terrible fact here, that owners of these news properties have discovered how much money they can make from them. Many of the local TV stations, the network affiliate, I don't know, in Champaign-Urbana, certainly in Chicago, certainly in Washington, have profit margins of 40%, even 50%. This is a staggering success story in capitalist terms. Once you've made that kind of money, I think if you're a businessman and a manager as opposed to a journalist, it's pretty irresistible not to want to keep making it. And that's what we see happening, that the Gannett Corporation, which owns 100 newspapers in America, similarly strives for a 30% profit margin for all its properties and gets it. The Tribune Company got 29.5% profit margin, as I recall, company-wide in 1999 or 2000, I've forgotten, which it must have been 99. So they know they can do that, so they say, geez, let's do that all the time. And the pressure then created for the news executives, the editors and producers who have to put out the news in that kind of a corporate environment, pressure grows enormously. They have to hold down costs, squeeze their expenditures to help the bottom line, and that's where the news suffers.
How much money does the Washington Post need to make to keep the paper in production and the owners happy?
Well, those are two very distinct questions that you've asked. The cost of producing the Washington Post is probably something less than $100 million a year. not a lot less. But the Graham family that owns the Post and the Washington Post Company, which includes Newsweek magazine and five or six television stations and a cable system that serves rural areas in America, and so on, the Kaplan Test Service, they are striving to be a very efficient, successful big company. Washington Post stock is traded publicly on the New York Stock Exchange, although the Graham family has a controlling voice in the operation of the company. It's a tricky corporate structure. The Sulzbergers of the New York Times have something similar. But the Grahams want to be recognized as good business people, so they strive for a good profit margin as well. They'd like to make on the Washington Post 15 to 20% a year, which is a very handsome return. You know, if you told the General Motors company that they could have a 15% return, they'd die and go to heaven. They think that was fabulous. But this is the newspaper business, and profits could be much bigger. So the Post is aggressively interested in profits, and we conclude that this isn't a bad thing, that you don't want to be in the position. For example, the Bingham family is a good example of this. The Binghams, like the Grahams,
in Louisville,
very public-spirited family, ran quite a good newspaper for many years. But we now know, it wasn't revealed at the time because it was a privately held company, but we now know that it was woefully unprofitable. Some years it actually lost money. It never made more than a single-digit profit margin. It was badly run, and it was badly run in part because the company was the family that ran it was answerable only to itself. I believe that. So having public accountability, having stockholders looking over your shoulders, I think isn't a bad thing, but how you deal with that fact is critical. Don Graham, our CEO, Catherine Graham's son, who runs this place, is very gutsy in his dealings with Wall Street. He goes up to a meeting of analysts every year and says, you know me, I'm not going to play your games. I'm not going to make any projections about our earnings. I'm not going to tell you about next quarter or next year. Here's what we're doing to make our business stronger. We think it'll work. We hope it does. We hope you'll support us. And that's the end of the speech. Whereas the management of the Gannett Corporation comes to the same meeting with charts and graphs and predicts down to the percentage point what profits will be next quarter, next year. They're completely tied to their numbers. And interestingly, the Washington Post stock trades at least as high a profits-to-earnings ratio as the Gannett Company stock does. Post stock does extremely well. So somehow, the strength of our name and our reputation and the record of the Graham family as business people has persuaded Wall Street that this is a very good investment, even though we won't pander to Wall Street the way so many media companies now do.
Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I had a quick question. Basically, what is your opinion on the rise of citizen journalism, specifically the independent media centers that rose up after the Seattle protests and other outlets? And how do you think that affects the larger world of journalism?
This is a good question about our changing media environment. To be honest, I haven't read enough of that Seattle journalism to evaluate it professionally. When the Internet came into our lives, there was lots of speculation that there would be a great flowering of independent journalists and independent journalism that would give new competition to the established news organizations. There's signs of this, like Seattle's, but they aren't very widespread, and there aren't very many of them. It's sort of discouraging, frankly, that there hasn't been more. From our perspective, and it's obviously tainted by our nearly four decades at the Washington Post, it's not easy for independent citizens to produce really good journalism on their own. Journalism is an art form. It requires experience and training. In our view, editing is terribly important to the journalistic process. Institutional traditions and standards are terribly important. It doesn't mean it's impossible for independent people to do interesting things, but I think it's hard. And it's also hard to avoid individuals using a journalistic enterprise for a personal purpose, to advance a cause that person believes in. And by our standards, that's not helpful. That doesn't, if you're emotionally involved in the story, it's less likely that you're going to actually be able to reveal its important aspects fairly than if you're not emotionally involved. Hmm. So it's a mixed bag. It's very early. We write about the impact of the Internet on the news business in this book, and one of our conclusions is that thinking about its impact now is sort of like trying to predict the impact of television in about 1949. We're so early in the process, we just have to see what's going to happen.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine is Robert Kaiser, associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post, one of the authors of The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril, his co-author, Leonard Downey, Jr. One of the great chapters of this book, I think, is the chapter where you take us through three stories, two successes and one failure. And this goes to what you were just talking about with this second caller, the art of journalism.
Yes.
Two are examples of great successes, as I mentioned, a story about the IRS and how Scientology won the tax-exempt status of a religious organization, that reported by the New York Times. And a story about the number of shootings of civilians by police in Washington, D.C., and that story or that series of stories done by your paper, The Washington Post. And there's an example of a great failure, and that would be the reporting on Iran-Contra, or
the lack of reporting.
The lack of reporting. let's talk, if we could, about the successes first, and maybe we could this way we could get some insight into how a story reaches the pages of a newspaper.
Sure.
What led Doug France to begin investigating that story about Scientology and the IRS?
This is an attempt by us, this chapter, to make our readers feel like insiders in the news business and to realize how things really happen. And your question puts in sharp relief one of the more interesting ones. I know from hearing from readers over the years at the Post how people assume that we sit around and plot out what we're going to do, and usually because we have some political agenda in mind. Doug France's situation, he's the reporter who wrote about IRS and Scientology, was much more typical. He was newly promoted to the national staff of the New York Times. His friend and colleague Dean Baquet, now the managing editor of the Los Angeles Times, had recently become the national editor of the New York Times. This was in the late 90s. And Doug, in the way that's typical for investigative reporters, was literally fishing for a story, looking around to find something that seemed like a worthy target for an investigation. And as he explained to us, and we recount in the book, he went to lunch with a friend who said, you know, there's something interesting in this story of how Scientology got its tax deduction as a church. And that was all it took, and he started to snoop around from there. And it turned out that the New York Times had a front-page story several years earlier. It was in 1992, I think, when the IRS granted Scientology this tax status. But there had been no explanation for why it had happened. On the face of it, it was quite odd, because for years and years, the IRS had fought against the Church of Scientology, which kept demanding this tax status of the church. And the IRS kept arguing, you're not a church, you're a money-making business. They'd actually won some very big court cases upholding their view, the IRS said. One of them just a few months before the reversal was announced. So why had they flip-flopped? What had gone into this was what animated France. And he discovered, by very diligent, very careful, painstaking reporting, that a lot of tantalizing evidence, but no final answer to the question. That's one of the interesting aspects of this story. Because the IRS is really protected from public scrutiny by laws that are designed mostly to guarantee the privacy of ordinary taxpayers, the IRS could and did refuse ever to give him a full and satisfying explanation of why they had changed their policy towards Scientology. But he could accumulate a very powerful circumstantial case which showed that Scientology had very effectively and persistently been harassing the IRS for many years and suggesting that perhaps this campaign just wore them down. Interestingly, the director of the IRS who made this decision, who's now a prominent Washington lawyer, who would never answer a question explaining himself, still hasn't.
And Doug France actually found himself in a very uncomfortable situation confronting Scientology about this and trying to do the interview. They came around and attacked him.
They did. This is, you know, the Scientologists are very aggressive in promoting their own interests and views, but they're far from alone in modern American society. Lots of institutions now have learned the arts of media intimidation or media cajoling or media inducements. And Doug confronted there, and I thought his account of it was very vivid and really helps people understand what can happen to an investigative reporter particularly. He was confronted by a really nasty, tough cross-examination of him by Scientologists even before he got out the first question out of his mouth. He was in a big conference room surrounded by hostile questioners, and they pored over things he'd written in the past and were accusing him of being an unfair journalist and really coming after him. And he just had to sit there and listen to that, wait for them to get their message off their chest, and then ask his question.
Hmm. To what extent are journalists having to deal with that kind of climate today in terms of our concerns over what it is to be patriotic?
Well, I guess it's easier for me to answer in terms of the specific question of what it's like trying to cover this war we're in with a Bush administration that's very hostile to the press in the practical terms. I don't know what their real feelings are ideologically or intellectually, but as a practical matter, they've made it extremely difficult for reporters to get a real look at what's going on the ground. And they have their public relations machine in full humming operation, and they are, you know, putting out their version of what's going on, declaring victories after victory and triumph after triumph. And we come along behind now. The Washington Post has published in recent weeks a series of investigations of specific incidents in Afghanistan that our reporters have finally been able to report out, things that happened weeks or months ago where they get to the location of a bombing incident or an attack on a wrong target and discover that there were considerable civilian casualties and that things had gone badly and not the way the spokesman had claimed or thought they were going. And it's a real public service, I hope and believe, to print such stories, but it would be much better to be there in the first place and see it happening as it happens, the way I was able to as a young reporter covering the war in Vietnam, for example. And so there is, you know, there is this attempt. It began really, in my opinion, most dramatically in the first Bush administration. The first President Bush did not like reporters, and he was the first candidate for president in 1988 who almost never answered a question from a reporter during the whole campaign. He just stiff-armed us. And this is a bad trend, but it's gained a lot of strength over the years.
Let's talk with another listener. In Bementa on the toll-free line. Good afternoon. Is there a caller there?
Oh.
Hello.
Yeah, I had to get to the phone.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway, you might call me a citizen journalist. I volunteer at another radio station, which is what they call a community radio station, and we do a labor show to help kind of counteract the gazillion hours of business programming in the mainstream media. And what my problem is, you were talking about occasionally, you know, or quite often the media will get into irrelevant things. There is very little coverage of labor issues. We do kind of get these workplace things that tell you how to basically dress right and how to act in the workplace, but we don't hear anything about what were real labor issues, things that were covered decades ago. And that's the reason why you have independent media centers, because the mainstream media will not cover a lot of stuff. For example, how much coverage was there of the EU meeting last week in Barcelona that said much at all about the 100,000 protesters? Very little, but you hear all about the EU ambassadors and whatever that was there. It's the same way with all these events. It's the same way on so many issues. While they were talking about Monica Lewinsky, there was any number of strikes and major labor disputes going on in the United States that usually the only ones you hear about are the auto companies and the airlines. And I guess what the reason they get covered so heavy is that journalists buy cars and fly a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. This is an example. I think this gentleman of what I was talking about before. He cares deeply about these issues, deeply enough to volunteer his efforts to work on them at this community radio station. This is a wonderful expression of his civic responsibility and a fine thing for him to do. But personally, I don't think he's animated by the spirit of independent journalism that the best news organizations ought to be animated by. That's not to say he isn't entitled to do and shouldn't do exactly what he's doing. It's absolutely fine to do what he's doing. And it's certainly fine to criticize the mainstream press for paying too little attention, I would say, not only to labor issues, but to working class issues, if you will, to the struggles of ordinary Americans who have not benefited from the great boom of the last 20 years, the people that are still working for less than $25,000 a year, of which there are millions, and whose struggles in many realms are important and interesting and underreported. We had a very, really interesting story in last Sunday's Washington Post about the disappearance of affordable housing for metropolitan Washington and how that affects working class people. It was a very powerful story. We ought to do more of that in our own paper and elsewhere.
Why isn't more of that done?
Well, I think because the journalist's impulse is to find a story, and so many of those situations are more sociology than news. They are important aspects of the reality of the society around us, but they often contain few dramatic elements. There's no smoking gun, literally or figuratively, and they don't involve conflicts, which journalists tend to like. They don't often involve ironies, which journalists tend to like. And so I think journalistic attention is just is distracted elsewhere too often. We have a number of reporters on this paper who specialize in that kind of work and keep our conscience for us. When I was a line editor, I used to try to get more stuff of that kind into the paper and had some success. But I think it's a underlying facts of life. Look at homelessness, for example. There was a great amount of journalism about homelessness in the 80s when the problem suddenly grew, I think, after deinstitutionalization began in the late 70s, early 80s. But in recent times, people write much less about homelessness. It's become part of the backdrop to daily life now. It's part of our environment, and it's chronic, and nobody's come up with any great solutions. And so there it is. And I think it's just harder to generate journalistic interest in those permanent fixture problems than it is in things that come along that are new or unexpected.
Let's talk with some other listeners who are waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm also, you're getting flooded with them today, but I'm another activist locally here in the independent media movement. I wanted to ask you about the phenomenon of media consolidation that we've seen in the 90s. The most vivid example, I think, is the passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which, in the terms of radio stations, created a great consolidation of ownership of radio stations to the point where you have entities like Clear Channel Communications, which now own over 1,200 radio stations throughout the entire country. And an effect of that is that when cost-benefit analyses are applied in this kind of corporate mindset, an effect of that was to see that local newsrooms across the country were absolutely gutted. I remember having the experience of speaking to a man from Wisconsin whose job was cut right out from under him because newsrooms, you know, by their definition, are not a profitable part of airtime on the air. Per minute, they cost a lot more to make than playing music or advertising.
This is an important theme of our book. News does cost some money. News is supposed to be the public service that broadcasters are supposed to provide. It says so in their license. But, in fact, the definition of public service has been eviscerated by Congress and by the FCC, so Clear Channel or anyone else who owns radio stations effectively has no real obligation to cover news or to maintain a newsroom or even to have a news, you know, top-of-the-hour newscast. They can dispense with it altogether. Media consolidation is a huge issue. It's a big subject of our book. You know, when we were young men joining the Washington Post in the mid-60s, most newspapers in America were still locally owned. So were the local television stations. Today, it's just the opposite. 1,200 of America's 1,400 daily newspapers are parts of chains or groups. And, you know, we've got a half a dozen Clear Channel-owned radio stations right here in Washington, D.C. I think it's a half a dozen. It's a lot. And this is going to continue. There was a recent court decision that invited the FCC to remove, in effect, the last restrictions on ownership. And I think this FCC is going to take advantage of that to do so. So we are going to see, unfortunately, increasing concentration of ownership of media property.
You know, the story about ABC trying to lure Letterman and dump Nightline has received a lot of attention. And one of the questions that's come up in relation to this story, will network news disappear? Now, 20, 30 years ago, who would have thought that possible? But, you know, here people are talking about
this. We had really interesting interviews with all three network anchors for this book. And one of the more startling comments then that we heard was from Tom Brokaw, and we asked him, what is the purpose of NBC News today? And without missing a beat, Brokaw answered, to survive. And indeed, all three of them said things that indicated that they were not at all certain of their long-term viability. And you're right, what Disney, the signal Disney sent to ABC News was pretty unmistakable. Personally, I think this is real stupidity on their part, not to recognize how important the anchormen themselves and the news organizations are to the identities of these three networks is just dumb. I think, you know, ABC without Peter Jennings, CBS without Dan Rather, and their news shows and their news operations would be totally interchangeable. They would have no distinguishing characteristic whatsoever. I frankly don't believe that they'll ever abolish the news or their news divisions, because I think at the end of the day they'll have to realize that what I said is right. They can't trade off.
One wonders, though, if they'll continue to eviscerate them.
Yes, one does.
Let's talk with another listener. On line two in Urbana, good afternoon.
Hello. Am I on?
Yes.
Yeah. I wondered, NPR has, or sorry, PBS on Friday evenings has a series of things that they call the
Frontline
News and Information Programming, mm-hmm. Which is... let's put it this way. It ends with Wall Street Week. What do you think of Wall Street Week as journalism, or is it really just a big infomercial?
This is an interesting question. The rise of financial news in all media has been one of the hallmarks of our age, but so has the ownership of stocks. You know, we printed a historic story, I think it was in 97, on the front page of the Washington Post, reporting that at that moment, for the first time in history, Americans had more of their personal wealth in the stock market than in their homes. And it's been true ever since. Americans are a stock-holding people now. Most Americans with 401k plans have a stake in the stock market. So I think we have to say that reporting on the financial markets is, for most Americans, relevant and important. And so that's a pretty good justification for doing those kinds of programs.
We're out of time. Before we go, one quick question, though. What do you hope people will take away from your book? What do you hope they'll do with this information, the news about the news?
Well, we wrote the news about the news largely in hopes that if consumers of news had a clearer and better understanding of what was happening to their news, that they would become an effective lobby for better journalism, better news. So I think that's my answer to your question. We would hope for, dream of, an ever more articulate and better informed audience. And news executives do respond to public pressure. It's an interesting fact. We know, because we've both been news executives. When you hear from an irate reader, an irate member of the public, it registers. And this blaming the victim that I talked about earlier, this thing, this line that people just want this junk, that's why we give it to them. If you hear from people that say, no, we don't want that junk, we actually want serious journalism, we hope and believe that would have a real effect.
Well, here at WILL, we have a comment line, and people regularly call our program directors. And as well, NPR now has an ombudsman.
Yep.
So I think that says that people's opinions are important.
Yep.
Well, Robert, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. Very good discussion.
Robert Kaiser has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He is associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post. Kaiser and the paper's executive editor, Leonard Downey Jr., are the authors of the new book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril.